Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another session of Career Talks. I'm your host, Orlando Haynes. And as always, super excited. I'm going to kill those phrases because I just get the pleasure of speaking with amazing folks each and every week. It is a selfish podcast, more or less, at times when I bring on folks that are sharing content and advice with job seekers, career professionals, and we're talking about development, future of work, best practices, etc. But I get to learn and network with some amazing people that a lot of folks should, you know, don't know. And we need to start collaborating more and getting folks out there speaking their truth. I just stole that from my guest. So in living our truth. But this young lady is phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. She has a strong background in recruiting and marketing, worked for some notable companies. And I'm pulling up her LinkedIn profile right now just to share. Lyft, may have heard of it, may not, right? I don't know if you're living under a rock and haven't heard of this company. She was a marketing event manager of recruiting there. Then with Twilio as well, another big company. And most recently, she has taken a role of senior manager, diversity recruiting and partnership with DoorDash. And without further ado, let me welcome on Andrea Long.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me. Good to see you.
How are you? How are you?
I'm doing well. It is a sunny day. So, you know, that always boosts my spirit.
Absolutely. Over there in Oakland, California.
Yes. So sunny California.
So we're a bit privileged. We're both in sunny states. So sorry for folks who are in cold states. Make the move. That's all I can tell you.
And pay the taxes if you come to California.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. That's why I'm not heading that way. I love it out there. But before we go any further, share with you, share with the folks, the listeners and the folks that have catch the replay, a little more about you.
Hey, everyone. So like you said, my name is Andrea Long. My pronouns are she, her. I currently work at DoorDash, and I have been at three tech companies now, and so have sort of seen what it looks like to go from pre-IPO to IPO in the startup unicorn space, if you will. So my focus, my original background of my career was in events and marketing. So I did a bit of affiliate marketing, event marketing, and partner marketing. And I was an ERG, or an employee resource group leader myself. I led the Black At group for a few years at Lyft. And through that work, I partnered with the recruiting team a lot. And I was able to use my marketing and event planning skills to negotiate down contracts for sponsorships of conferences and to make sure that we were branded correctly on LinkedIn, for example. And so in that work, I was able to actually write a job description and pitch a new role. And so I was the first person to do recruitment marketing and employer brand at Lyft. And that really introduced me to this recruiting and diversity and inclusion industry. Went over to Twilio and did a bit more work focused on events and partnerships globally. So got to host partner events in Singapore and in London and Madrid and across the US. And now I'm at DoorDash, where I'm focused on both enablement, which is programs and processes for the recruiting team that focuses on diversity and inclusion, as well as partnerships. So a lot of different initiatives fall into the world of work that I'm doing right now, but everything really ladders up to diversity recruiting.
Can we just give like a virtual hand clap on this dynamic career this young lady has positioned herself for? So that you said something pretty interesting there. So you you wrote your own job description and created the position.
Correct. Yeah, I was at a place in my career where I had been doing event and partner marketing for a while. I was really comfortable as a marketer, I was learning that getting consumers or acquiring consumers was different than acquiring candidates. And I liked that intentionality behind the acquisition of candidates and being able to talk about your employer brand, talk about why it's a great place to work. And so through my sort of volunteer work as the employee resource group leader, I was exposed to this industry and had many mentors across the company, including my then manager and who would be my new manager, who were completely supportive, really walked me through what that process looked like and helped me create the role that would be the best to utilize my experiences, but also to give me room to grow.
Wow, that's something I think you need to teach on at some point. we talk about like the closest most folks, including myself, will get to, because we don't think in that fashion, right? We don't think in that fashion. So everyone sees the job description and you see the ad hoc duties. That's where that little sliver is like, okay, I get to add some of my talents that are not on this job description. But you actually took full-fledged and created that. Like, what was that mental space for you to be like, and then actually landed the job or fell into that role? Like, what does that look like? What are those conversations, one, with yourself, and then when you're presenting it to be like, this is why I think I'm the best candidate for the role?
Yeah. So for internally, I think I'm good at things. I think I'm good at a lot of things, and not in a cocky way, but I spend a lot of time studying different industries. I spend a lot of time learning, and I believe in like continuous education. And so I do think like if I put my mind to it, I can figure this out. I feel pretty confident in that. So internally, I feel like I didn't have to do a lot of convincing. It was more the external. I had to really show how my skills were transferable to folks when I was moving from a marketing organization into a recruiting organization. And even to this day, I would be the first person to say, I've never actually been a full service recruiter or a full cycle, see the words, a full cycle recruiter. But I have learned a lot about the programs and processes that it takes to build an effective recruiting process. From an external standpoint also, networking, I believe, is very important both inside of your company and outside of your company. And so the making the switch and getting the introductions to the right people wasn't really challenging because I had already built the relationships to connect me to the right people. So even though I didn't necessarily know the person who would be my then manager, I knew someone who knew her or knew someone who was on her team and had someone help facilitate that introduction. So I am someone who will talk all day about how networking is really important and how we can't just focus on networking outside of our companies, but we have to do it internally as well.
I love that. So you already had the fundamental skills. It was just under the marketing umbrella. You created this job, pitched it, sold on it because you already do the research, right? You know how to speak. You're good at interviewing and communicating well, which are right some of the fundamental skills for recruiting. Mm-hmm. It's being able to talk to folks, engage, and understand where they're trying to go on their path and if there's a match. So that's phenomenal. We talked about this offline. Go ahead.
Yeah, and one thing I want to add though is I also had an example to show. Because in my role as that ERG leader, I had worked on a conference, a particular conference that we won't name, but it was for people who identify as Black within the tech industry. I had negotiated that conference sponsorship down by $50,000. So I saved not my team, the recruiting team, $50,000, and also got 4 hires from that event. So the fact that I had already been doing the work also eased that transition.
Wow. That's impressive. Very impressive. Yeah, congrats on that. So with that, and we talked about this offline about imposter syndrome. So was there a moment that even entered into your mind? It was just like, I'm not a full cycle recruiter, but I see the transferable skills and I think I can make a big impact because I'm already doing it at a larger scale.
Yeah, so most of my imposter syndrome came prior to my experience in tech. Mm-hmm. So for example, I worked at a marketing agency and there I was a coordinator. So I was like lowest rung. I think I made it to specialist, but pretty low on the totem pole, right? Or on the priority list. And I still had client facing meetings, just like the directors and just like the account executives did. And so we were all in these rooms with these brand names at stores you probably shop at. And that is when I felt my imposter syndrome. When I was the one who was really doing the tactical day-to-day work and could tell you exactly the ins and outs of that business, what partners were the most successful, how much week over week growth we were seeing, et cetera. But in that room of people who had these higher titles and were at these fancy companies, I felt super, super intimidated to speak up. But I also think because of that, that helped me find my voice at later companies. Because I had a manager who in a performance review told me that I wasn't getting promoted because I was slouching in my chair one day. I then took that I learned later that that was called a microaggression or a macroaggression, depending on how you interpret the level of severity. And I said, I will never be made to feel this way again. And I will never silence myself in a room when I know the answer. So for me, I think that having that imposter syndrome did sort of was, I was able to flip it on its head and really use it against itself. So now I'm able to do things like write a job description and get a new role.
Awesome. So let's transition into how you obtained your current role. Was that the traditional method or was it through internal networking because you knew some people that worked there? How did that come about?
Yeah. So every job I have ever gotten has been through networking. So this one, the same. I met this amazing woman who works at the company and who's been here for several years. We have networked externally. We both identify as Black women. So we're in like a Black women who work in tech group. And we've been able to have several conversations. And so she was really pivotal to me getting this role and really being able to give me sort of the insider scoop on what was really going on and advice during the interview and things like that. So like I said, I wholeheartedly believe in networking and this this role was no different.
Awesome. So now let's pivot again to just the, let's talk about best practices in recruiting right now. So with the current pandemic, you being in the West Coast with a well-known tech company now, what's it like to acquire talent? Is it much different? What are the struggles? What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, in a virtual space, I think that an important piece of acquiring talent is making them feel the culture remotely. So how can we really bring to life what the company values, how we operate, and maybe even what it felt like to be in the office? I've seen some companies do office like video, like a walk through the office in video form. And I think it's really such a great idea because as someone who got a new job during a pandemic, onboarded remotely, has never met anyone in person, and has never been to the office, it's like a beautiful way to be able to bring that culture and that environment to life virtually. So I think that we need to be thinking about how we can really show candidates what it's like to work at our company in a remote environment.
That's awesome. I like it. Like the virtual walkthrough. Now, is that something they're doing? And did DoorDash do that for you?
So we have not done that yet. Okay. but working on it, like I said, haven't been there, but they recently reopened our offices on a volunteer basis. So now we have the opportunity to go back and do some recordings if we need to.
Awesome. Yeah, I love that idea. It's almost like it's stealing the idea from real estate.
Right. Exactly.
Virtual walk through that's super cool. Something they can embed either on the, you know, the intranet or an email, something, but like here's the office. Here's
exactly. Yeah, and it doesn't have to be super like high budget. It doesn't have to be super scripted. Like I think that kind of video would perform better actually being really just like bare bones, shot on a smartphone, just sort of walking through and being a little, you know, shaky, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think really like the authenticity.
Or even if it's almost like if you did FaceTime for someone, you'd be like, you know what, I'm in the office. Hey, let me just show you what it looks like.
Exactly.
That's super cool. How are you now implementing your marketing background to your current role?
Yeah. So a big chunk of my role, like I mentioned, is diversity recruiting partnerships. Mm-hmm. And so I look at diversity recruiting partnerships the same way that I looked at partner marketing at Lyft, where I was working with Anheuser-Busch and Tostitos to acquire drivers and riders. I think it's really important to remember that it is about the recipient or the attendee's experience and not just us as a company sort of forcing a perspective onto them. So how can I utilize partnerships and events to really provide tools and resources that folks can use is so important to me. And how can I market them correctly to reach an audience who might not think that DoorDash is a place for them? So whether we are marketing using, you know, LinkedIn banners or LinkedIn events, for example, mm-hmm. I think it's really important that we widen our reach so that we can access folks who might typically self-select out of attending a DoorDash event.
So now, so the types of roles you're recruiting strictly around drivers and what else?
So I actually, so I'm more focused on industry recruiting, which is all of our sort of corporate roles that require two or more years of experience. So all the way up to like directors, senior directors, C-suite, et cetera, and down to very entry level. I just have a couple of years out of school, or I just have a couple of years of work experience. So DoorDash is hiring like wildfire across the entire business, from technical roles to non-technical roles. Sales is booming. So in terms of what roles am I focusing on, I actually utilize partnerships in many different areas of the business.
So talk to us a little bit about that, because I want to steal some ideas. I'll be honest, right? As I told you, I just joined a marketing company here in Florida. Though we may be perceived as a subject matter expert, it's best to collaborate and get fresh ideas for those folks who are kind of blazing a trail. So what are some unique ways that you're leveraging partnerships to acquire talent? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, so I can talk about one partner that we're working with right now called Sisters in Sales, which was founded by a woman who works at LinkedIn, actually, whose name is Chantel George. She is amazing and has created and curated this audience of about 3,000 Black and Latinx women who work in the sales industry. And so we know that they are quite underrepresented in sales, and especially in sort of leadership director plus roles. And so with them, we're working together right now to be able to curate an event, again, that provides resources to their community and doesn't just talk about DoorDash is amazing, blah, 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 which sure we are, it's great. But how can we give the event attendees something to walk away with that they can implement in their work or they can implement in their life day to day after the event? So something that I find really useful is not just having a panel, but actually having breakout rooms where candidates or members of the partner organization can talk to recruiters, can talk to hiring managers, and even talk to the panelists in smaller groups so that they can really get more comfortable asking questions and interacting. It feels a little bit more similar to our in-person events that we used to do. And so sort of bringing that element, that personal connection, if you will, to life.
Okay. Awesome. So here's kind of a personal question for you, but professionally related. How important it is or was it for you to know that the organization that you partner with, as your background is in the diversity recruiting, that it was intentional versus a checkbox?
That is the ultimate question, right? I think that, you know, as someone who identifies as a Black woman, I look when I'm either interviewing at companies or I'm selecting partners or, I'm speaking with hiring managers. I am always constantly evaluating, is this a checkbox experience or do you really, really, truly care? And I think you can tell by the execution. If a partner is really authentic about who they're selecting to be a speaker or be a panelist, who they are involved or who is in their membership. Like, are they really actually building relationships with their members, or is it sort of a transactional relationship? I know for myself, there's a lot of companies that have implemented a version of the Rooney Rule, or if you're not familiar with it, a rule where they have a requirement where there's either a woman or non-binary person and a person of color at the final stages before you can make an offer. Mm-hmm. And for me, I can tell you my track record with interviewing, I have made it to a lot of final rounds. And not to say I should get every job I interview for, even though I think I'm amazing. I know that's not the reality of it, but I do question every time I make it to a final round, was I just a check the box? Was I just here because of the Rooney Rule? So I think that diving deeper, asking questions, finding what their intentions are is so important.
That's pretty interesting, right? Because it makes you look back as a Black male over my career personally. I knew when I first got into talent acquisition, phenomenal staffing firm, But when I interviewed, so apparently I beat out so many people, who knows, came there, and then it was immediately apparent, like within the first week, it was only me and another young lady who was African-American, and that was it. I was like, okay, all right. So had no background in recruiting. A couple of years later go by, come to find out who I replaced was also Black. I'm like, And the moment it came up in a conversation, there was an awkward silence in the room. It was probably 2 years in. And I looked at my manager, like the rest were all white male and a few white females. And it was just a state of shock. Like, do you guys just bring me on because I filled a slot? Right. Yeah. So Rooney Rules probably wasn't back then, but it was definitely at that moment, from that moment on. And I stayed with the company for about 4 years. But at that 2 year mark, that's when it immediately felt like a token hire. I was like, wow. And I was like, are you kidding me? But luckily enough, I was doing well. I didn't get no immediate upfront bias, but that was a moment in time where I was just like, wow.
And it's so unfortunate, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how can we as TA professionals prevent that from happening, mm-hmm. while still giving folks who are underrepresented the opportunity to get to the final round and to get hired? So those are the things that I sort of think about in the work that I do every day.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Okay, so let's talk about now culture, right? As we talk about intentional diversity for organizations, you said a key word, right? What is the impact? What is actionable? What is actually implemented and getting done, especially from folks who have a diversity and inclusion title? And I talked about that with a previous guest. As you noticed, when the whole George Floyd thing happened, and I mentioned this on the last podcast, that massive amount of D&I positions were available. And the thought process was, wow, they're checking boxes quick.
Yes.
Scrambling to not get any backlash from the Black community, which was pretty interesting. And then I was like, okay, we get the corporate letters and we're on your side, but it's like, where's the action? Are you hiring folks to really make change? Or is it that checkbox? But I say that to say, where's the culture going now, right? What are companies really doing to change culture? Or are we still just making sure we're checking boxes, pushing a widget, so we maximize market share, et cetera? Is it strictly a business or, business move? Or can you see, or whoever your colleagues are during your network, are you seeing actual cultural change woven into that diversity program?
Yeah. So talking broadly about the industry, mm-hmm. I think that we will know that it's not just a check the box, and we'll know that it's truly change once we start to see people of all identities being reflected in marketing campaigns. Once we see minority and women and veteran-owned businesses who are actually in this preferred supplier programs. Once we see people of all identities leading these companies, I think that there's a lot of, there were a lot of Black squares, let's say, in June 2020. And after the Black squares, there were a lot of podcasts and blog posts and a lot of donations. What I have yet to see are a lot of Black executives. Mm-hmm. I do think some companies have made very strategic moves, and I definitely applaud them. I think one example of maybe sort of a controversial company right this second, but Peloton hired an amazing Black woman to run their marketing and branding, and had a great campaign during Black History Month, and has worked really hard, it looks like, from an external perspective. I've never worked at the company, but from an external perspective, they've worked really hard to incorporate Black artists, not just during Black History Month as well. And so I do think, there are some companies that are making progress that, as a consumer, I'm enjoying putting my money into and spending more time following. And as maybe a future candidate, I definitely have a hit list, if you will. But I do think that we need to call people out where it is not happening, because the culture of specifically the tech industry, we can clearly see the lack of change based on who is still leading the companies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. A lot of people say all you got to do is go to the company page, look at the executive board team members. if it's not there, even though it may be trickle down into the frontline leaders and things like that. But yeah, it's folks are looking, especially the big companies, you know, if they're Fortune 500s, Fortune 100s, 50s,
yeah,
where are we at that executive level?
I think, like you were about to say, we're out there, but change does take time. Yes. And I know that I am a harsh critic, and I will admit this. So maybe we check back in June. We give another month. It'll be about a year. And then we can maybe do a status. Yes,
oh boy, you got 30 days to make this change. Yeah, and honestly, we're asking for big changes, but we're not asking for anything that's going to hurt the business, right?
If only it's only going to help the business, right? All of the statistics that show that underrepresented leaders build more diverse teams produce better work quicker and are more likely to stay at the company longer. There are so many stats to say why this is helpful to the bottom line. So we're not asking for anything harmful to the business. In fact, what we're asking for are things that are going to help the business and really help their profits.
Yep. And we're asking, you know, put the best person in place. Don't put a person of color in there just because you do it, and then they're not equipped to do the job, and then now that shuts down. Like, look, we can make this person the CFO, and they're incapable, and now this is why we don't do X, or you know, promote African Americans. It's like, really, right?
So, yeah, and I think that happens so much where maybe someone does get a role, maybe someone who identifies as Black or Latinx does get the job, whatever the job is, right? But if they're not resourced correctly, if they're not given budget, if they're not given a team, if they're not helped or given assistance with building those cross-functional partnerships, then how are they going to be successful? So it's not just about getting that person in the door, but also how are we giving them the resources to really thrive, similar to how we're giving resources to their overrepresented counterparts.
Absolutely. So another question on culture would be, in a diversity role, what does culture mean to you? Because, right, you're bringing these folks in. So you have to know, you're speaking, like you said, you're the advocate. We're the advocates for the organization. What does culture look like for you?
That's a really interesting question, because whenever people reach out to me and say, hey, what is the culture of this company? Mm-hmm. I actually put it back on them to say, what does culture mean to you? Is it the perks? Is it the free food? Is it the 401k? Is it, you know, the way the company operates? Like, what does that mean? I can say from my standpoint personally, I think that culture is how folks can communicate opposing opinions. And how folks have access to leadership, to like, is this a company where I can Slack the CEO and say, hey, thanks for that talk today, or hey, I have a piece of feedback for you, or is that frowned upon? Those are the kinds of questions that I ask. Mm-hmm. From a TA professional standpoint, I think, again, culture means a lot of things to different people, so we have to be encompassing and consider that people have different motivations, whether it is financial, it's the perks and benefits, it is the way the company operates, or it is the way that people who are underrepresented feel included. So I think when I'm speaking to different candidates, when I'm hosting events and prepping speakers and selecting questions for panels and things like that, I'm really trying to tackle many different aspects of culture, because I just don't think there is one culture.
That's true. That's a phenomenal answer. And I kind of think of it the same way, too, is where coming into a role, I look at how much autonomy will I be afforded.
Mm-hmm.
Changes, you know, from a brand perspective, a talent acquisition perspective. What can we do? Can I try 10 things, fail at 9, but the 10th one work? And are you okay with that? Does it require some funding? Maybe not. But I need to know that you're open to any and everything to bring in the talent you're looking for, because that's the number one task. And we can't go into it with any shackles, no pun intended, no nothing like that, but we can't go into it hindered and say, produce. It's like, okay, here's my ideas. Here's the scope of support I need. Like you said, we can't just be put into a role, which regardless of the role, without the support needed, you know, for us to execute in our role. So that's, yeah, I love that answer you gave. I love that. So what are some of the challenges you're seeing now? Because you're, again, you mentioned that you're going from entry level, some entry level tech roles to, you know, executive C-suite roles. What are some challenges that you're seeing from the West Coast that may or may not be different from East Coast?
Yeah. I think that a lot of the challenges that DoorDash specifically and tech companies specifically face are the prioritization of speed versus intentionality. And all the tech companies that I've been at, all the tech folks that I've spoken to, this is a problem that is perpetuated throughout the industry, where we want to go fast. We're moving quickly as a business. We are exploding and the growth is amazing, which is so great. Mm-hmm. However, the faster you go, the more likely you are to sort of skip processes or lose some of the intentionality behind some of the sort of programs and policies that we have in place to build a more equitable pipeline or a more inclusive recruiting practice or interview cycle. So I think that the speed versus intentionality is always going to be the biggest challenge for every company, frankly. Mm-hmm. I don't know that anyone has figured it out. Because who wants to go slow? Like, that's not what this is about. That's not what tech is about.
So are you saying that tech is, and again, this is a industry question based on your background and expertise, that tech companies go fast on product but slow on people? Or is it they need to take those practices, right? Be first to market, without skipping processes, so there's no hiccups. And I forgot where I heard sometimes some people say, put it out there. If it's ugly, great. We'll fix it as we go. What's that correlation with fast on product versus fast on people?
Yeah, I think that really depends on the company, because I've been at companies that where they put out their MVP, their minimum viable product, and they say, as long as like we can get really basics done, put it out and we'll make it better later. And I've been at companies who really do pride themselves in putting out quality product from the start. And so I do think that that differs by company a bit and isn't necessarily industry-wide. However, I will say that that's on the product side. I still think on the people side, we all have the same problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I was watching a gentleman on YouTube who talks about the, you know, kind of gives like a three-a-day update on the stimulus packet. And he said something that's obviously in the news, but I'm not a big news watcher. So what he talked about was really the impact of the stimulus checks having on slowing the economy up, where people, well, not necessarily the economy, but the job market, where folks are returning back to work.
Yeah.
Especially at the hourly rate, the service industries, the customer service roles.
Yep.
Where folks are making more money at home versus going back to work. And I caution job seekers on doing that, and I get it, but I caution you that you don't wait too long and wait yourself out the market, right? Because there are folks extremely hungry out there. What are you seeing, and would you have any advice for folks who are kind of in that space as you recruit for some of the entry-level positions?
Yeah, I think what I would say to some of those folks, the entry level, is don't think about the instant gratification. Think about the long term. Yeah. The longer you wait to get into the industry, the slower your progression will be, and therefore your compensation might be stagnant. So if you're making this very like compensation-based decision, which I'm interpreting it to be, to say I can make more money based on stimulus checks and unemployment and staying at home versus getting into the industry, then I would also, from a compensation standpoint, say, well, maybe right this second, but think about a year, 2 years, 10 years from now. You know, there's a lot of studies that show the upward mobility in salary and compensation that someone has within the tech industry. So I do think about the long term and not the instant gratification is what I would tell that person.
Awesome. And would you say it's more a little more risky because of tech and how tech moves so fast and evolves, that if you're someone who's kind of stagnant and waiting for, you know, the government funding to stop, you're not staying abreast? You could have graduated 8 months ago.
Yeah.
And what you think is still relevant has shifted and you never kept up because you're not in the market. You're just sitting back.
That's a really great point. Like even just being able to get those skills to make yourself more valuable in the long run. I think that's an excellent point for sure.
Oh, well, so you heard it first from Andrea Long. Get yourself, get your butt back to work, folks.
And if you're looking, let me know.
Exactly. Right. What are some things that you're looking to implement that you have on your, you mentioned a kill list. I think we were talking off, or you might've said it while we were online, but from a process standpoint,
yeah. Right,
what are some new creative things that you're like, you know what? I think this will work. And is that coming from just your background, or are you learning these new things from different industries? It's like, oh, wow, I see oil and gas did that, or energy did that from my colleagues. And you're like, would that work in tech? And how do I tweak it to fit this, you know, to fit this industry?
So one thing that I'm working with our team on, which maybe isn't the newest, most inventive thing, but is something that I don't think any company has perfected, is job descriptions. Mm. Inclusive language, the length of the job descriptions, where we're posting them. I think there is so much from a marketing and data standpoint about how we can optimize job descriptions to attract the candidates that we want. So we recently revamped our job description template, removing words that were perhaps triggering or would have some underrepresented candidates self-select out, reducing the length, because we know that on average, a job seeker will spend 49.7 seconds reviewing a JD before they decide if the role is a fit for them. Mm-hmm. So we have less than a minute, people. So how can we use that 50 seconds as best as and most efficiently as possible? And then we also are utilizing an AI tool. I know there's a couple of competitors out there, so don't want to drop names today, but there's AI tools that will sort of parse through the language you use in your job description and flag certain words. They'll provide recommendations for correct or alternative words to use. And they will also give you a score. And some of them even will show you where on sort of the gender spectrum the job description lie with who you're most likely to attract in with that job description. So I think that using data and marketing to really optimize these job descriptions is something that a lot of companies have tried, but I don't know that anyone has like really unlocked it. And I do think that it probably will look a little bit different at every company because we're all sort of looking for different profiles.
That's interesting because it to your point, I believe a lot of companies will just rest in their laurels of the brand and say, hey, we're big tech. Who doesn't want to work for us? And we'll slap the generic, tweak it a bit. But that's interesting. Now, so does that tool, and you can share with me offline, does that tool look at the industry that the job description is in? Or is it just you just throwing it in it doesn't matter what, whether it's a tech role or, you know, finance role or project manager role, does it decipher that way?
It doesn't look at the industry. It looks more at the field. So like the is it a marketing role versus a sales role versus operations? And we've also done some studies to really A/B test. Mm-hmm. What title works better? Should we have job descriptions that are inclusive of multiple levels or just a single level? If we say senior associate or just associate, how does that affect who applies? So it's looking more sort of granularly versus industry-wide.
So with that, and this is just us talking, so no one else, right? With that tweak, because I'm going through that now, tweaking it to see if there's a spike, literally overnight, just based on the job title. Mm-hmm. So going from senior associate from associate, is there a change in the actual job description or is just the title?
Yeah, so we've A/B tested just the title. So saying 3+ years of experience for a senior associate role versus an associate role. Mm-hmm. And then we're currently like testing to see how that changes the candidate. So I'll definitely let you know once the test is over. And then also, I lost my train of thought. Where did it go? Yeah. I'll definitely update you after that test. But I think that it is so interesting that we can see like really specifically mm-hmm. the demographics of the people applying. Something that I've also learned is if you're going to A/B test, make sure to post the roles exactly at the same time and not edit a role, because the websites like Indeed and LinkedIn that are parsing to collect the job descriptions and post them on their sites, they only do it once every like 60 days. So if you're changing your job description too frequently, it's not likely to be updated on some of these job aggregate websites. And so and if anyone knows differently, please correct me, because I'd love to learn. But I thought that was really interesting. So like, as we are thinking about testing, we need to make sure we're doing it really intentionally from the beginning. We need to make sure that we are running our job descriptions through this data tool from the beginning instead of making edits as we go along.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm definitely, like I said, we're doing it now, and we've seen a switch just in title. It was eye-opening, literally, for the role, because we will recruit from entry-level call center roles to C-level, right? Mm-hmm. Some executive roles, some mid-level roles as well. But really on the entry-level role is where we saw the immediate spike overnight from 3 applicants to 15 applicants based on, and had both job descriptions posted, both jobs. Yeah. The body of the job description was the same, only the title change, and we see which one spiked the most. And we're like, obviously, we know they're not reading the job description.
Well, that's so true, right? I mean, does anyone else just scroll down to the requirements and not actually read the rest? Like, I feel like it's human nature. You scroll to the requirements, and then you either self-select out or you say, okay, maybe, and then you go back to the top and, like, actually read what the job description says.
Exactly. They're like, okay, hiring, blah, blah, blah. Okay, yeah, let's go for it.
Exactly. On to the next.
And then when you call them, I'm sorry, what company? Like, you
don't have done that. Did it
15 minutes ago or a day ago. You don't even recall. keep a running log, folks. Keep a running log.
Yes.
Let's talk about some of the things that you've seen work since stepping in your new role. If it's anything that's been in place with DoorDash or something that you were able to implement in the time that you've been there, what's worked?
Yeah. So something that I was able to implement that I'm really proud of is being able to collect candidate data from sourced and referred candidates. So for those of you out there, basically when you are applying on the website, you're called an inbound candidate or an inbound applicant. And often, I would say 99% of the time in roles in the US have demographic data listed on that job description. But if you're not applying on the website, if you're like myself, where you don't believe in applying online and you only apply to jobs through referrals, or you were sourced by a recruiter, so someone reached out to you, then many companies have different processes in terms of collecting that demographic data from those sourced and referred candidates at other stages in the process, since they didn't do it at application stage. And so I came into DoorDash and they were sort of figuring out what process they wanted to go with. And so we have turned on automated job post emails sent through our ATS to candidates so that they can really tell us their demographics, so we don't have to rely on visual ID data. So I think it's really exciting that we are able to empower candidates and interviewers to give us their data so that they can contribute to us building more D&I policies and practices based that are data driven, right? We want to make sure that we're not just pulling a rabbit out of a hat here. We're like really making decisions that are rooted in the data. And if there was one thing I would love to sort of build upon that and figure out is how to remove the stigma in underrepresented communities about giving their data. I know, again, I am in the Black community. There's a lot of sort of swirl around, if I say I'm Black, they won't hire me, or it'll hurt me, or maybe they will hire me because they need more Black people. But we know as TA professionals, the data is aggregated. you can't see it on a one-on-one basis. And so it's really important for us to teach candidates why we collect that data, why it's important for them to tell us, and how they're helping the D&I efforts as like a greater good in the long run.
Yeah, and that was my follow-up question. How does that play or impact on a greater scale the diversity program to employ more brown and black skinned folks of any any race that fits that demographic? So is that coming from you? I can tell that's intentional. All right.
Yeah.
Well, it's to be intentional 100% of the time. So how is that helping you target those folks to where you can find those talent?
Yeah. So what I would say to someone who is contemplating sharing their demographic data with a company, I would say, one, it is aggregated. Two, people don't have access to it. It does not affect your interview process. And three, an example of how that can be helpful to yourself and people from your community, people who look like you, is if we have the data, we can look at pass-through rates at each stage. We can see trends and then build programs and processes to mitigate against them. So for example, if we have collected a lot of data and we see that Native women are dropping off between recruiter phone screen and hiring manager phone screen, we can dig a little bit deeper to say, well, why is that happening? You know, is it only recruiters in this industry or on this team, or is it one person? Is it many people? Is it systemic? We can ask a lot of questions and dive really deep into the data to uncover the underlying issue and then build a program or a process to prevent it. So without that data, we can't build programs and processes that are really specific to the exact challenges a company is facing.
That's pretty cool. Now, I'll take that same process and I'll peel it back. Are you tracking from an application standpoint, or just click through on the page and to see if you're seeing, okay, we're noticing applicants are staying on our profile, our page for, like you said, that 49.1 second. What does that look like? And is that data being tracked as well?
Yeah, so that depends on the company as well. That is usually managed by the website team, which is usually not in recruiting. I have worked on a career site as well. So I do know that we can see how many people are clicking through. We can see what the application percentage is or the rate based on the number of clicks. We can see how long people are staying on the page. But again, it's like very aggregate from Google Analytics. It's not like, hey, Orlando, I saw there was a black man on the page for 10 seconds. Like, that's not it.
That's scary. Now, that would be scary.
Right? And I mean, let's be real. Some of these companies do have a lot of data, but like, that is not it. That is not what we're doing. Everything we're looking at is really to be able to make it a better, more equitable process.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I want to be absolutely mindful of your time. Share with us some advice for job seekers. For those of brown, black, Asian, whatever descent, that will help them, in this current market, be more visible in some tactics. Share with some of your tactics because you said something pretty powerful, right? All your jobs are networked. You don't even believe. And it's kind of ironic, right? you don't even believe in using the standard application process system. How do other job seekers leverage that kind of network prowess to get noticed?
Yeah, so I would recommend that one, you find your niche. And whether it is you find a group of marketers, you find a group that's alumni from the school you went to, you find people who live in the same area as you, whatever it is, join a group, join a LinkedIn group, join a Facebook group, join a Twitter thread, a chat. I'm still figuring out Twitter. I don't know how to do that yet, but join a group, join a conversation, and have something meaningful to say, and build a relationship. So don't just watch, don't just be the lurker. Pick one thing, one question, one comment, one, oh my gosh, that happened to me too, so that you can build that relationship. I go to networking events both pre-COVID and in a virtual world. And my objective is to meet, depending on my energy, 1 to 3 people each time. So if I'm feeling like I'm having an energetic outgoing day, I'm going to meet 3 people and make 3 good connections. And if I'm feeling a little tired, I'm going to be okay with just 1 person. It's still going to be worth my time. And so trying to set goals like that, often what I'll do in some of these virtual events is if somebody writes a comment or asks a question that I like, I then private message them and say, hey, oh my gosh, I had the same question. Thank you so much for asking. Or, hey, I live in the same neighborhood. I have the same issue. Like, let's talk about it. So building those one-to-one relationships is really important. And then I also would say optimize your LinkedIn profile so that it's searchable. So many recruiters rely on LinkedIn these days for sourcing, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And we know that it's basically like a sophisticated Google search, right? So you want to put the words that you think the recruiter is going to search on your profile. So you can look at my profile. I have marketing. I have diversity, inclusion, recruiting, Black woman. Like, I have a lot of words to optimize the searchability of my profile. So that's something I would recommend to folks as well. A lot of people maybe don't see the importance of LinkedIn, but it really is keeping us connected. And especially at tech companies, recruiters and hiring managers rely on it so heavily to source.
Awesome. Awesome. Last question. What's next for you, whether it be professional or personal? What's next for you?
Yeah, so I'm also an entrepreneur. So I run 2 businesses. One of them is called Firewood Events, and it's a wedding planning, event planning, virtual live event company. Awesome. And the other one is called Swag by Asayo. And that company produces swag and gift boxes that have products from all Black and Latinx small business owners. And so for me, what's next, or sort of what I'm doing in tandem, is focusing on how I can grow my businesses to build generational wealth and to help support other Black and Latinx small business owners through selling these gift boxes and swag boxes for events. So I'm really excited about those projects that I'm working on.
Awesome. Wow. I didn't know that. I would have dove into that earlier as well, but I didn't know that. So thank you so much, Andrea, for your time, your wisdom, your expertise, your insight, and just your authentic self. It comes through every time I see you speak. Absolutely. What's the best way for folks to really follow your content? Is it LinkedIn? Is it any other platform? I know you said that Twitter.
But I'm learning Twitter, actually. So you can follow me on Twitter at the Andrea Long, because Andrea Long was already taken. and I please teach me, send me your tips. And I'm also on LinkedIn. I'm just / Andrea Long. So those are the 2 places where you can find me. But always happy to chat and share resources with folks. And I really appreciate you inviting me on today.
Absolutely. And I'm going to put her on the spot right now, because she mentioned something about a book that may come out.
Maybe in the future. Give me 5 to 10 years. But
to those that follow Ms. Long, encourage her to put that book out. You see the wisdom come through. Let's give it to the people. Don't hold back. Let's get it out there. Let's give her a date of this time next year.
Oh, that was real quick. It's for a ghostwriter.
Right. They don't have to know. Nobody have to know. No. It don't matter. Long as it's your wisdom on this page, don't matter who's writing it, right? And it's in your voice, so don't even worry about it. But thank you so much. Don't go away. I'm going to just close this out, and we'll chat behind the scenes. But thank you so much. God bless, and continued success, everyone.
Thank you. Music.